Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning.
Well, welcome today. Today we have the awesome Dr. Freddie Hebert visiting us today and talking with us on our Getting Smarter podcast. And so I'm so happy that you're here today. How are you today?
I'm doing just great, and thank you so much for having me.
It's so wonderful to talk with you. So I have this wonderful biography of yours that I'm going to read and start us off with. It's just incredible. And so there's so many things that I want to talk to you about. So I'm looking forward to today. Dr. Freddie Hebert has had a long career as a literacy educator. First, as a teacher's aide and teacher of primary level students in California, and subsequently as a teacher educator and researcher at the universities of Kentucky, Colorado Boulder, Michigan, and California Berkeley. Her research, which addresses how fluency, vocabulary, and knowledge can be fostered through appropriate text, has been published in numerous scholarly journals and books. Through documents such as Becoming a Nation of Readers from the Center for the Study of Reading in 1985, in Every Child a Reader, Center for the Improvement of Early Reading Achievement, Dr. Hebert has contributed to making research accessible to educators. Dr. Hebert's contributions to research and practice have been recognized through so many awards, such as the American Educational Research Association's Research to Practice Award, and also there's so many others. Among the awards that Dr. Hebert has received in recognition of her contributions include, as a researcher and educator, are the School of Education Alumni Achievement Award from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the William S. Gray Citation of Merit Award for outstanding contributions to the field of reading from the International Reading Association, and her election to the Reading Hall of Fame, as well as the selection as a fellow of the American Educational Research Association. Dr. Hebert, it's so great to visit with you. How are you?
I'm doing really great. I'm
Oh
doing good. Yeah.
my goodness, thank you so much. There's so many things just in your biography that I want to talk to you about. Before we get involved in this, thank you again for visiting with us today. And so, before we even get started, can you tell me a little bit about why did you go into the field of education and teaching? What was the incentive there?
My career goal when I was finishing high school was to become an attorney, which was pretty unusual at that time because keep remembering, I have been around this field for a long, long time. But when I was a sophomore in college, the initiatives from Johnson's Great Society began. And one of those was Title I, Chapter One, tutoring. And it turned out that there was a local school close to my college where you could get, I think you could get about 80 cents more per hour, like you could get $2 an hour rather than $1.20, which was work study. And so I started doing that with really, I had not planned on becoming an educator. And I absolutely was engrossed with the process of watching children. And a lot of the kids that I was tutoring were English language learners. Many of the programs that were being used at that time were based on learning hierarchies, like the Sullivan readers. And some of the material was so incredibly boring. But I was just amazed at at the resilience of the children. And also the processes by which they became were kind of beginning to navigate the code. And so that's how I got into it. And I have never had a moment of regret. It's been I still every morning I get up and I have devoted my mornings to writing since I was in graduate school at Wisconsin, typically taught in the afternoons. Which works when you're in teacher education programs, right? Because teachers often come after they've had a full school day, which is not great for them. It's great for the instructor. I've got so many questions to answer, and I continue to view the process with so much curiosity and also just amazed at what we know and what we also don't know. For example, this morning, if I could go on here,
I love that. Yeah, tell me
you can
more.
stop me any moment you want. But my colleagues and I have a data set in which there's information on the how long it takes kids to read a word, and this data is in centiseconds. Okay, so that's 1/100th of a second. And I've never, I mean, obviously I've looked at data on kids' oral reading for a long, long time. But when you start looking at it at the level of just really minute detail, it's amazing what you find. I mean, for example, one pattern, and we're going to have to, do a lot more data analysis to confirm this, but one pattern is, kids who don't know a word and aren't particularly good readers, they just skip it. And so you've got these big gaps, in the data. Or a pretty proficient reader sees a hard word coming up, like the word document for a second grader, and they start making a lot of errors on the little words, which actually, when when the computers compute oral reading fluency, that counts against you in terms of
Right.
accuracy.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that really calls into question the ways in which we've been measuring things.
Wow, that's fascinating. So what is it, a sample? It sounds like it's a large data set. You have a
I think that there are about 1,500 students reading at least a handful of passages several times over a school year. So we're going to be able to, we've just started, I'm just looking at the data to make some hypotheses because it's so big
Yeah.
before we start wading in and get ourselves overwhelmed with data. What are the really important questions to be asking here? I'm incredibly interested in automaticity. I think a lot of the conclusions we've been making, based, for example, on the National Assessment of Educational Progress's fourth grade data, really reflects automaticity in recognizing words. Given enough time, most of the words can be recognized. But what I'm interested in is if you give kids a text where the balance between potentially unknown words and known words shifts, how they do. So the passages I've been looking at right now might have like 88% of the words are from the first 1,000 versus another data set where 67% of the words are from that same group. And how does that influence? Like if you're not
Yeah.
really automatic with words in certain bands of vocabulary, of frequency, I'm hypothesizing that that can make a really big difference in your ability to navigate some of these passages.
That's so fascinating. So, wow. So what led you to that? What led you to that project? Because you started off with this really wonderful idea about how things just are continuing to make you curious, and you still want to. I'm almost wondering, like, what led you to that, and also just kind of over your career, you have so many. I pick up anything and you're cited, and it could be curriculum, it could be vocabulary, it could be all these different avenues of some of the, you're so multifaceted in all the different areas. So I guess to unpack that question, so when you. How did you get involved in this particular project, and then maybe some projects throughout your career that have really maybe
Yeah.
stuck with you?
Well, let me explain this one. I've long been concerned with the representation of American children and their capability as readers as a result of the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So yesterday I was reading something where somebody was saying, a third of our kids can't read. The point is that, yes, 36% of the kids on the last national assessment at grade four didn't score at the basic level, but no one really knows what the low basic level means. What we know is when given 700 to 800 word passages and asked to answer 10 questions, three of which will be written open response questions, they don't get enough right to get to the basic level on the scale. That's a really different way of describing them than saying they can't read. I remember I was once at an International Literacy Association luncheon, and Miss America, this is probably about 25 years ago, and Miss America was standing up there and she says, "I'm going to help all these children who we have so many millions and millions of children who can't read." Well, I mean, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 year olds probably can't read, but that doesn't mean that kids can't do something. And so, what's happened over the last, what, since 1996, 1994, the NAEP, the National Assessment, has done a handful, actually three, oral reading fluency studies. And the last one, which was done in 2021, this is the incentive for why I'm working on this, basically took a look at fluency data and a rather unique word identification assessment that I'm not certain is word identification, but we can come back to that. But they made conclusions that the kids needed word recognition. These kids in the bottom, in the below basic, needed word recognition and phonological decoding instruction. And I've spent a lot of time looking at the DIBELS data. So the NAEP data is really hard to get access to. And this was during the pandemic. I couldn't even go to DC to go into a locked room to look at the passages. So I one passage is released and you don't know how much to conclude from that. But my thinking was, on DIBELS, kids at about the 12th percentile read at about 94% accuracy. You can't, you have to have some word identification, which was also what the general idea that the report from the NAEP, the Oral Reading Fluency Report, also concluded. I mean, that they could have a fair amount of word accuracy. You can't have that level of word accuracy if you aren't able to read anything, because the DIBELS are not puffball passages. So I started doing, some analysis of what kids were able to do and when they were able to do it. And my conclusion basically is that it's and this was published in Reading Teacher, I think in 2022, and it titled something like What Can Below Basic Students Do? I want to really focus on what they can do. And so I started looking for these big data sets that, because of so many curriculum-based measurement assessments, they're all over the place, but sometimes it can be hard to get access to them. And so we've been able to get access to some people have been very generous to us. But my point is that what appears to be the problem, two problems. One is that multisyllabic words create a problem for kids. Excuse me, I had some allergies and I'm going to need to just drink a little water here. So the point is that a handful of multisyllabic passages and words in a passage are going to cause you some problems if you're not good with that. And the second thing is, if you haven't read enough text where you've actually gotten really good at the words that account for 80 to 90% of the words in text, if you're having to figure some of those out, or you're really slow with them. Okay, so if you're not highly automatic, then that's going to cause a problem too. So my reason for looking at these big data sets is I want to know, what students know and when they know it, and particularly how their automaticity is with words in different bands of word frequency. Okay, so there are like what, 25 words in English account for 33% of the words in text. You add another 70, and that accounts for another big chunk, right? And what my colleagues, Amanda Goodwin and Gina Cervetti, and I reported in Reading Research Quarterly is that by the time you've come up with about 2,500 morphological families, that accounts for about 7,000 words, 7,000 of the most frequent words, you've pretty much got 92, 93% of the text handled. Well, if you're not really good with these different bands, you're going to be really struggling, and you're not going to have a lot of capacity when you come to the multisyllabic words. You'll have lost the train of thought. When LaBerge and Samuels talked about automaticity theory, they didn't say you needed to be automatic with everything. What the automaticity theory basically is, you're always going to have 2 to 3 words you've probably never encountered in every 100 words of text. But the deal is that you've got to have enough bandwidth so that you can attend to those words. And if you're having to attend to a lot of other words, then it's going to be a problem. So that's why I've gotten into, I want to know what kids know and when they know it, because I'm so tired of hearing kids classified, on the basis of a pretty hard comprehension test, which is the NAEP national assessment. And the state tests are like that too. I mean, most grade three state tests, have 650, 700 word passages. So you can interrupt me. I've kind
No,
of been on a
yeah.
little roll
Oh,
there,
I
but
just find that fascinating, and I love how that your focus, but then also how that has sort of magnified into all of this really kind of looking at that fine detail of what's actually going on and what kids can do instead of that position of what kids can't do. I think
right.
so much of the narrative right now in the field is I wouldn't necessarily in the literacy field, but I think in wider educational policy is, that just deficit perspective of, the science of reading debate and what kids can't and how schools are just continually failing. And I love that focus on, okay, well, actually, let's look at these measures. Let's look actually to see what is going on
Right.
instead of making these broad statements about what kids can and can't do. I really love that way of approaching it.
And one of the things to also consider, so one of the things that these databases do now, the one that we're currently looking at only starts with grade two, but another one that Jerry Tyndall at University of Oregon was really generous in sharing with us, it actually starts with kids in grade one. And what I'm interested in is the pace at which instruction moves in phonics and the profiles of the kids who actually come to school to learn to read. Okay, so there's some kids who come with a fair amount of knowledge about literacy. And what I hypothesize is the curriculum is model is built for them. So the curriculum now moves quite
Yeah,
rapidly.
right, to accommodate those kids. So how will you look at that? Will you look at what's the thinking behind looking at that data set?
Well, I mean, what we look at is what words do kids know and when do they know them? Right? So what you and really breaking it down by orthographic patterns, especially vowel patterns. And what you're seeing is that if you think of American kids in three triads, kids who are now described because of the NAEP below basic, I describe them as kids who come to school to learn to read. Okay, and then there's kind of a middle triad, and then there's a triad of kids that Jerry DiAgostino and Becky Rogers at Ohio State described before the pandemic, basically saying that as a result of efforts like No Child Left Behind, various efforts pushing reading into kindergarten, kids were coming to first grade more prepared, all kids, in terms of phonemic awareness and foundational skills. But it turned out that the gap between that top triad and the bottom triad became bigger because more of the kids in the top triad could read at least some words when they came to first grade. So how do you differentiate curriculum while keeping equity? I mean, I think that's a really critical question that we have to address. You know, so it's not, I'm not, I don't want anyone to think that I'm talking about dumbing down a curriculum. I'm talking about ensuring that we have really sensitive assessments. And I think a lot of them that we have right now are either too fine-grained on the one end, and then too, once you start reading text, it's the grain size is too big. And I think that, you know, with good digital access, we could actually attend to some of the needs better. But I think a lot of this takes some major revision about how we view children and what they need.
Tell me more about that, if you're thinking with that.
Well, you know, we have an alphabetic language. English is alphabetic. That means that we never put a weird symbol in. We're starting now to have a few more accents and so on for particular languages. But we don't, you know, remember Prince, the singer, he tried to change his name to a symbol, but that never really made it because newspapers didn't know how to print it. We don't put icons despite how much, you know, people put those in their texts. But the thing about English is it's quasi-regular. And David Sher, you know, who's been known for the self-teaching hypothesis at Literacy Research Association in 2022, just gave a smashing address to the Word Study Group on how English is an outlier. Okay? So, I mean, the thing about English is we have two linguistic sources. Few other languages too. So, I mean, English starts out as a Germanic language. And then, you know, in Great Britain, when the Normans invade, they bring French and Latin. And those are two really different systems. And the morphological system influences the phonological orthographic, like in words like nation and national. But we have to keep remembering that these patterns function differently as a result of these different linguistic sources. So if you've got a quasi-regular language, you've really early on got to help kids get set up for a set for variability. You know, in one of the first reading research studies done by Gibson and Levine, they published a book in 1970, one of the first books I ever bought as a graduate student, and they described set for diversity. Well, we don't use that term like that anymore, but they were already talking a lot about to read in English, you need to be able to recognize that things aren't always going to. The vowels aren't always going to work up. Consonants do. And that means since the consonants are pretty consistent, you can apply alphabetic knowledge to your words. You just have to be able to ensure that that word makes sense in the context that you're reading. My mind is going in another direction. I don't want it to. So let's say stop it. I'll write it down and then maybe we can come back to the point because I use the word context. And in some places with three queuing systems, that's like that's verboten. But let me get back to this point about the quasi-regular nature of English. You know, there's really some good research done in Europe that shows that when you have a quasi-orthographic language like English, it takes some time to learn to read. And what we've done is we've pushed things down to kindergarten. Nobody asked any questions about that during NCLB. I was just kind of like, I'm always raising my hand. You say, I don't get it. We can't do this. You got to have some time to get used to to what school is and also what the language processes are. But you've also got to understand things about the morphological system. So there's a lot of interesting things to know about. And you know, kids learn it. But I think that there has to be a modicum of consideration and not placating kids, not being condescending and patronizing, but recognizing, you know, that there's a lot to learn here and presenting information not in a way that leads to incorrect perceptions. So currently, we have a model for decodable text that is based on the notion that if you've taught a letter sound correspondence in a lesson, and that letter sound correspondence appears in a word, and all the letter sound correspondences in a word have been taught, that word is decodable. Well, it turns out now that we go through all the short vowels in kindergarten, consonants, right? So that by the time you get to first grade, I mean, some of the stories can start looking a little bit more interesting. But the deal is, you know, all the letter sound correspondences don't have equal weight in our system. And, you know, it concerns me that we leave little guys with the expectation because they get all this cam, can, sit. You get tons of text like that with short vowels, and then steadily some of the words with the regular vowel patterns like the and of. But these little guys must be expecting that, you know, everything's going to work. So we're actually feeding them a diet that leads away from a set for variability. And the other thing to keep remembering is if you don't know what a word is, you don't know if you've decoded it correctly. I am not a fan of nonsense word tests, especially for English language learners. In one study, we were giving, you know, a rec rec a test with a really strong reputation, and I told this little girl who was, you know, spoke Spanish as her primary language, but was really great at English as a first grader. And I said, you know, we're going to play a little game. And it was a nonsense word test. And she finished it and she said, that was not a game. That was not fun. So I'm just saying, if you don't know what a word is, then you can't know if you decoded the mystery, right? I can't be a detective and decode mysteries if I don't know what the mystery is. So, I mean, I worked on Becoming a Nation of Readers and got to spend time, actually, a wonderful lesson that Jean Shaw and Isabel Beck gave the whole commission on phonics, which was really interesting because there were a lot of people on the commission that were, you know, cognitive scientists, instruction scientists. And one of the points that Jean made very strongly is that you use phonics with ideas that are familiar to kids. And then you move to more unfamiliar once you've gotten, you know, you've got the code. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do informational text. So at Text Project, I have all these texts that I've written, right, about things like mud and ants and all kinds of things like that. So you can write interesting texts on, you know, things that kids know something about or that are interesting, snakes, when you're doing long vowels. But what I'm saying is that we've got had this disposition that we just gotta knock these kids. We just get this phonics into their heads. And I please don't, if anybody's misinterpreting me and saying that. I'm not saying that isn't important. It's incredibly important. But at the same time, you've got to have some flexibility around it. You've also got to, understand some things about morphemes. So you need to understand that, they're using the word bats. Oh, and then there's also words take on different meanings, like the word bat. Many words in the language are polysemous, especially among common words. That's why they're so frequent. I'm just saying the stance that I'm taking is rather than just being all worried that they didn't decode all the nonsense words right away, I'm interested in, that's what I've been doing is writing books that are based on a model of phonetic regularity, but also are based on a model of high imagery words and highly concrete words, i.e., things that are familiar. Because those things have been found to really influence kids' word recognition. The high imagery, but we don't hear a lot about that.
Why do you think that? Why do you think we're not hearing? It's a tough question.
Well, I think, there always has to be vigilance. And I think some things kind of got out of hand. And I think kids weren't being supported with the scaffolding of the alphabetic system sufficiently. And I think that we're seeing, a response to that, especially from a group of parents whose kids really struggle with understanding systems, especially the alphabetic one. And I just don't want every kid to have the same diagnosis in our schools.
So you mentioned you put that context you were saying, and then you talked about the three cueing system. Do you want to revisit that idea? That you.
Well, this is an area. I mean, so what? I don't know if this is apocryphal, but I mean, from my research, a number of states have actually said, put this into law that that's not supposed to be part of instructional materials or instructional strategies. Now, there were some real problems with the model of guided reading we had. And I've raised these problems, and I'm also attempting to have conversations with both sides of the aisle, as it were. So one of the big questions with guided reading, was the use of a picture text match in selecting books and in telling kids to use that. So for 20 years, I've been saying in presentations, if you really want to develop some disabilities in kids, use the pictures to figure out tell them to use the picture. I think that's really been problematic. From that stance, I can understand the vitriolic response to the three cueing systems. But the point is that syntax and semantics are always necessary because of the polysemous nature of English, and also because of the quasi-regular orthography. You do have to test your hypotheses, and your hypotheses are not based on picture matching or on guessing. It can be that I use the first letter and the last letter, and it is an irregular vowel. Okay, so I say the word "feld" when it's actually "field," or I say the word "heed" when it's actually head.
Mm-hmm.
If I can't use context to verify my hypothesis, I'm never going to develop the set for variability. So what it does, it takes meaning out of the mix pretty quickly. And I mean, the whole thing about language is, language is the most unique thing about a human being, right? We have language systems which other species don't. And if we take meaning out of the mix at the beginning levels of learning and just make it something else, that becomes problematic. So I don't know who's been taking this question on, but I'm saying, as a field of reading researchers, I think we need to see some good reviews of research that ask questions about making it a problem if you teach kids to confirm your well-grounded hypothesis. Keep remembering, I'm not saying you're guessing. I'm saying you're making a hypothesis around the word HEAD or FIELD. I mean, just think about my name, right? ELFRIEDA. Okay, in German, the second vowel does the talking. But I can remember being a little kid and a doctor calling me Elfrida. And it was kind of like, why is he doing that? And then, somebody had to explain it to me. So I'm not. I don't know. I don't know about anybody right now. Maybe you do. Who's actually doing a major? I've had a scholar write me from Australia, but this isn't quite in my bailiwick. I do stuff on vocabulary. I do stuff on word recognition. But some of these higher level comprehension processing studies, I'd have to spend maybe 18 months looking at research on that.
It's interesting. It's there's it and maybe over your career, I wonder. It does feel like there's heightened emotions around some of these. I mean, it could just be my perspective, but has it just feels like there is it feels a little bit
Well,
more now. What
you
do
know
you
what?
think?
I can remember in 1988, 89, teachers marching out of a presentation I did when I would talk about the need for attending to word level
Huh,
systems.
really?
I mean, they would just, and then I mean, one of the things that was different is that you weren't trashed on the internet in the same way. Now, I mean, the turnaround can be so fast and pretty vitriolic for the whole world to read, you know? People can say things now and they're given license to. And I think that's what's different. But I was just thinking about, I have not been a fan of level books, and you probably can't see that on my record. But I've used level books in two studies where we reorganized them according to a curriculum. Linnea Eyre did that in a study that's reported in 2007 in American Educational Research Journal, a very prestigious journal. One of my studies was in Reading Research Quarterly, and the other was in AERJ also. But we organized books around, critical patterns, common regular patterns. And so I've been, I mean, that's something now I'm talking about with people, like, can you do some reorganization around the text you have? Because I hear people throwing away a lot of books. Well, we did a meta-analysis of texts used in interventions, and we found out that decodable, and when I say decodable, I'm meaning the lesson to text match model. I have a model called multi-criteria text, where you consider the decodability of a word, its frequency, and also the commonality of its pattern, and also its concreteness or imageability. That's a different perspective. And we've done some studies on that. But I can just see people now, walking out on presentations when I say that. So do I think that there have been a lot of emotions? Yeah, I think so. And I mean, when we did Becoming Nature Readers, some people would travel long distances to yell at me. I mean, they
You're so
would come,
lovely. Why?
they'd come and say, "Do you know what that book has done to my classroom?" And it's kind of like, okay, that isn't quite what we said, but
Yeah.
I mean, what I came away from that, so that was pretty early on in my career, is that the solutions of one generation, when taken to their extreme, become the problems for the next. But yeah, I think it's a different environment because there are a lot more voices that you can hear. And I think it's hard to know the credibility of voices.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm wondering, you've been involved in so many, and you're just continually involved in so many pivotal and important projects and research, and is there anything that surprises you about the work or your work? Is there anything that has surprised you over the years, or is anything
One of the things that surprises me is some of the things we don't know when we go into major policies like we are now around orthography and decodable text. And I have a whole list of questions. I've raised them at two conferences so far. I'll raise them at AERA in a month. And I've asked people to tell me if I've missed some literatures. Let me give you an example. One publisher advertises, and they have a really high score on Ed reports. They advertise that they cover 150 spelling sound correspondences.
That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, all spelling sound correspondences, as Seidenberg says, I mean, some of the more obscure ones, he doesn't say this exactly, but you're going to acquire some of the less frequent correspondences as you do more reading and have solidified particular correspondences. So it just surprises me that in BNR, in Becoming a Nation of Readers, we said, stick with the common and most regular ones. In National Reading Report, a panel said, that's something we don't know the answer is, how many, how in depth, and so on. Now, in my state of California, we mandate, the lesson to text match, and we have since the 2002 adoption. And we do that for interventions. And we say in interventions for kids from 4th to 8th grade, we have to have 9,000 words of decodable text with two books for every spelling sound correspondence. I mean, so where did that come from?
Yeah, where is that?
And, I'm honestly
Yeah,
asking,
yeah,
and I'm
yeah.
not saying that that might not be so. I just want to know what the data are. Okay. So I'm just saying that there are some really critical questions that I can't find answers to. And that surprises me. It surprises me that, for example, it surprises me that I've asked around, and maybe I don't have the right friends, but one of the things is I'm not shy. And so I will contact all the people. And I've been asking, who's working on a response to this three queuing system? And please don't think that I'm talking about guessing as a queuing system. I'm not. I'm talking about verification of solid hypotheses in the context of syntax and of discourse and semantics. So that surprises me of how we make decisions of what to answer and what we do.
I mean, there's so many questions I have. So, do you have suggestions you feel as though for, I mean, for policymakers right now? I mean, what's your thinking with that? That's not a hard question.
Well, I have, funny you ask. So I wrote a little piece in the Phi Delta Kappa, came out in October of 2023. And I basically asked, I raised some questions. So here's another example of something we don't know a lot about. In Becoming a Nation of Readers, there were some really serious questions asked about the texts that were being used, and we were still in a model of William S. Gray's high frequency words, even though there had been some shifts, but that basically was it. And the texts were pretty boring. And the statement basically was, is if you got inventive writers, could you create more texts for young readers that were kind of on the model of Dr. Seuss? And that's what I've been trying to do with these topic reads and decodable reads at Text Project. And by the way, reader listeners to this need to remember that everything at our website is open access. That means you can use it, you can't sell it, but you can use it. Okay, so it's intended for teachers, tutors, parents to use with kids. And you can ask me about my business model later. I mean, how do we make money with everything? That's But one of the things that we lost when we went to what was called authentic text only was repetition. So we went from having too much repetition to, Barbara Forman in a paper in 2004 in SSSR journal said that about, 40% of the words were single pairing words in the Texas decodable text adoption. I was on the same panel as her and David Francis, and David's a really good statistician. He was the one who'd done the statistics for, and I didn't know David. And both of us came to that session thinking that there was an error in our data. How could you give beginning readers text with 40% of the words appearing a single time? And it hasn't changed. So in decodable text now, there's a different rationale. You don't want kids to memorize the words. So you have to give them a lot of different ones. What? I mean, you need to have some repetition of patterns so that you can start making templates
Yeah,
and
building connections.
So do what I have to say to people in the little piece that I've just written, it's little, but I spent a lot of time on it. It's going to go into the California Reader, a magazine for California educators. And what I basically say is there's some things we know a lot. Like, let's not argue about whether you need to guide kids through letter sound correspondences. That's a done deal. Okay. We know that you need a set for diversity or variability, but there are other things that we don't know, like this business of coverage. I mean, like if you advertise, and this is on like the front of a publisher's page, all 150 spelling sound correspondences, and I'm kind of going like, oh my God, for a little kid, that would
That's
kill
torture.
you. And just think of the, I mean, I would be exiting the teaching profession if I had to go, and
How
it's
fun
just,
would that be to teach?
yeah. I mean, and that's said with pride, and it's said under the aegis of science. Well, and if somebody's listening and they know different, I need to know. And I'm asking questions in a genuine stance of asking questions. So, and that's a really hard thing to talk about with policymakers, is we know this for sure. But the thing about science is, I mean, one of the things I'm seeing is a lot of like science says this. and it's a single study, we believe in replication.
Right.
And we also believe in the evolving nature of science. And that's a really hard thing, I think, to communicate.
Yeah. So I could talk to you for days,
Really? I don't, you
So
get very
smart,
tired.
and I mean, you really are just a hero. And so as you think about this in your work and all of the work that you've done and you're doing, what about your current view? I mean, I don't want to talk specifically about the science of reading, but I mean, what do you think about the current, given your career and how you've transformed thinking and policy and the work that you've done, what about your current view to the field on where should we be going next in terms of other questions we should be asking?
My hope is in this discussion, not between you and me, but at this point of time, that if people are walking out on what I say, that other people can trust that I maintain a commitment to the kids who come to school to learn to read and to the teachers who are committed to teaching them. And I'm going to put the best stuff out there, both on my website and all the things that I put on the website. We've tried out, they're based on research. That doesn't mean we've tested every single book, but it does mean it's based on a linguistic model of learning to read. And my hope is that, when a plaque gets put up for me someday that people will see this unusual name and say, she was committed to the kids and to their teachers. And honestly, Margaret, I review that commitment every single morning
Wow.
and every night. And I have pictures all over my office of the kids we've taught and of teachers that we've worked with. I just have to keep answering the questions that I think are important. And I am incredibly fortunate because I have a domestic situation where I have somebody who absolutely adores me and gives me the space here every morning. For about 3 hours, I sit in this little office and I ask questions, and I have the most amazing friends. I have just incredible friends who work with me and who are just, I mean, I'm so fortunate. And so we work on different questions.
I love that.
And I feel really, really lucky that I got to be a teacher and got to be an educator, and I get to have this time. I mean, I hope that teachers will see that the answers that I'm working hard to give have integrity to them because they don't have the 3 hours a day to sit. Most people who do teacher education don't have the 3 hours to sit here and think through. So when I hear, when I'm on a webinar and I hear about this new study from the NAEP that fourth graders below basic need phonological decoding, I have to say that I'm triggered. And do I have other writing obligations? Yeah, I did. But then I just marched right ahead and just I was just like, we can't see this. Is this true?
Right.
I want to know, is it true? And then, is there an alternative explanation?
Yeah.
So that,
I
Margaret,
love
is
that.
fundamentally why I do it and what I do.
Oh.
So I hope there's something useful here in our conversation that
Oh,
you want to
it's
share with.
amazing. You're amazing. I thank you so much for spending time with me and helping us to get smarter. And you're just such a hero, and you always will be. And the work that you've done and you continue to do. And I love the idea of asking questions. And
Well, I just wanted to say a little something about your work because you got me involved And when you asked me to write the foreword for your book on literature, and then we collaborated on a paper for the reading teacher on the literature of hope, I spent January and February of this year reading children's books and books for young adults because I was giving a presentation for a state where I wanted to cultivate this literature of hope. And that's something we did at Text Project during the month of February. That was just such a privilege. That's an example. You're an example of where I find new friends, new collaborations, where I can learn new stuff. And that was just, it's made a difference in how I view my life.
What an honor. Thank
Children's
you.
literature is just, you open,
Oh,
I'd sort of forgotten about it.
you're what an honor that is to hear you, to visit with you, but to hear that also. And you're a treasure.
Oh,
Thank you. Thank you.
thank
Thank
you.
you.
Thank you. Take good
Thank
care.
you. I'll talk with you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks again, Freddie.